or reconvene the hearing.
Thank you, Sid. So the first witness would be Dr. Charles. I think you've heard from him before in this process, so you can deal with this qualification and experience. A summary of his evidence has been circulated, and hopefully you've got that in front of you.
Yes, we have. Thank you. Yes, Dr. Charles.
Summary. The business zone contains both noise generating and noise sensitive activities, leading to inherent tension or conflict between those activities. The Queenstown and Wanaka Town Centres. With respect to the Queenstown and Wanaka Town Centres, in my opinion, the operative district plan does not effectively address tensions between entertainers and the residential visitor accommodation activities. Consequently, there have been numerous long-standing problems relating to noise. Policies in the proposed district plan promote nightlife in Queenstown and Wanaka Town Centres, and are explicit that residential amenity will be compromised to an extent. I'm not aware of a technical solution that would avoid the need for a compromise such as this. In my opinion, the noise rules set out in the proposed district plan for the Queenstown and Wanaka Town Centres are consistent with the relevant policies. The rules include requirements for sound installation of new noise sensitive activities and the establishment of entertainment precincts to assist in the management of conflicts between activities. Numerous submissions seek to make the Queenstown and Wanaka Town Centre noise rules either more stringent or more liberal. For the reasons set out in my evidence, I do not consider that any material changes to the noise rules are justified beyond those in the recommended version attached to the evidence of Ms. Jones. Local shopping centre zones. General sound insulation requirements for the local shopping centre zone in Frankston are more stringent that acoustic treatment requirements for Queenstown Airport buildings and other proposed district plan zones. I consider that there is no justification for additional airport noise requirements in the Frankston's local shopping centre zone. I have reviewed the evidence of Mr. Christopher Day and Mr. John Kyle relating to the Frankston local shopping centre zone. In terms of sound insulation, I agree with the evidence of Mr. Day and Mr. Kyle, who in turn expressed agreement with my evidence in chief. I also agree that it would be preferable for ventilation rules for the Frankston local shopping centre zone to be consistent with the revised ventilation requirements in Chapter 36 for other scenarios. However, I do not consider this to be essential, as can be inferred from the evidence of Mr. Cullen. Mr. Cullen sets out tests for acoustic treatment and asserts that I have oversimplified those tests in my evidence. Mr. Kyle is correct that compliance with the acoustic treatment rule can be demonstrated by using specified constructions or providing certification. The key point that I was highlighting in my evidence is that if airport noise is less than 57 dB LPN, then certification can be provided automatically without further assessment and without any treatment. Airport zone. Mr. Day and Mr. Malcolm Hunt have provided acoustic evidence relating to visitor accommodation and general noise limits for the Queenstown Airport. With respect to that evidence, I agree with Mr. Day that short-stay visitor accommodation in the Queenstown Airport zone can be appropriately designed to mitigate noise effects. However, in my opinion, people sleeping in any visitor accommodation in the Queenstown Airport zone should remain within the definition of an activity sensitive to aircraft noise. As for all other types of activity sensitive to aircraft noise in zones outside the Queenstown Airport zone, the fact that effects can be appropriately managed through sound insulation requirements in the rules does not mean activities should not be classified as activity sensitive to aircraft noise. I agree with the general intent of Mr. Day's proposed controls to manage the nature of any visitor accommodation in the Queenstown Airport zone. However, I do not consider that an explicit limitation on the maximum length of stay is necessary, so long as any visitor accommodation in the Queenstown Airport zone is not used for long-term residential type use. I agree with Mr. Hunt that the standard sound insulating construction set out in Chapter 36 might not be sufficient for some locations in the Queenstown Airport Zone. I therefore recommend that any visitor accommodation in the Queenstown Airport Zone be required to have individual certification that the indoor design sound level will be achieved. This should address the key issues raised by Mr. Hunt. However, I'm not certain if there is scope within Remarkable's Park Limited submission to provide this. Mrs. A and Mr. Hunt both comment on the noise limits applying to sound from activities in the Queenstown Airport Zone received in the neighbouring zones. I've addressed this issue previously in my evidence on Chapter 36 in Hearing Stream 5. In summary, I agree with Mr. Day that these noise limits should only be in Chapter 36 and not in Chapter 17. I agree with Mr. Hunt, and disagree with Mr. Day, that the differences from other zone noise limits are not justified, although I understand no scope has been identified to make a change. I disagree with paragraph 29 of Mr. Day's evidence, where he equates the situation to the Queenstown Town Centre.
Yes, good morning. Let's just check with you in the legal submission this morning. On page 9, there was a conversation about the airport zone, Wanaka Airport. And I just want to check there with you. You were there quoted and referred to in terms of justification for noise limits for the Queenstown Airport Zone being more lenient than other zones. And we were traversing the point about whether or not there was scope within submissions. And I'm assuming that you've provided advice on a review of the submissions in relation to that point made.
So I haven't been asked to get any submissions relating to the Wanaka Airport Zone.
Right.
So I've looked at the acoustic evidence of the Queenstown Airport Zone. I haven't gone through on the scope to take advice from that.
Okay, all right. No, thank you. Switching into Queenstown and Wanaka Town Centres. If I sort of stand back from the issue, are you really saying against the background of numerous long-standing problems, complaints, presumably by residents and others, about noise, the issue is being addressed this time because the proposed plan is clearly signalling change, and it's signalling that residential amenity will be compromised to an extent, using your words. So that kind of justifies or provides support for more lenient noise standards.
So in the operative district plan, the noise limits in the town centre are relatively stringent. So they, to that extent, they do provide the residential visitor accommodation in the town centre. Virtually no bars could operate as they'd like with the carriage under the operative district plan. So any bar that's got an outdoor area with people chatting and socialising and having a bit of background music there, they'd break the noise of it after 10 o'clock. So there are a large number of resource consent stores and generally granted to operate bars and entertainment with higher than noise levels. And through those processes, clearly the noise limits that are often granted are much lower than the bars would like. So the bars feel they're being constrained, and at the same time, every time a high noise is granted, usually there's a residential visitor accommodation is adversely affected, and hence coming back to the Environment Court. So at the moment, if the operative district plans, the noise limits were no resource consents were granted to breach the noise limits, then the nightlife in the town would essentially be non-existent. And it's just there's a very sort of inefficient and compensational process. Under the proposed district plan, whereas the operative district plan doesn't set up a particular hierarchy between the incentives and the residential disaccommodation. I've heard different planners interpreted different ways, but there's no clarity on that, as far as I can see. I suppose it's just that it's a very clear hierarchy where the nightlife and entertainment takes priority and then the residential functions of this accommodation is compromised.
Well, it's compromised or secondary?
Yeah, from the noise point of view, it's compromised in the fact that it's a lower standard of the amenity than is desirable.
Alright. Just popping back into the operative plan and the resource consents granted, is it your understanding that they're commonly dealt with by way of limited notified type approaches, or how have they been dealt with?
I've seen a mixture. It's probably a question better directed to the planners, but that's more I've been involved with.
And is it your view that, notwithstanding having travelled through the resource consenting process, the entertainment or the bar operator ends out with a circumstance that still doesn't meet their needs in terms of operational?
That's what I'm saying. What typically happens is because you've got the benchmark of the noise limits in the opposite district plan. Generally, when I was advising council, I get involved in advice laws on the resource consensus. Where there are residential visitor accommodations, we're trying not to exceed those by any great extent. So the bar ends up with an awful lot of management controls. And so there's quite a lot of overhead administration for all those consents.
Alright. Looking at the consequences of changes brought about by a more liberal approach to noise in the proposed plan. Have you given consideration to sort of the shifting of that cost onto accommodation operators? If you any feel for
so from a noise point of view, I've provided all the technical information as to what it means, and that's been up there. One of the things that I was very keen on is every time this conversation arises, someone says, oh, we'll look at the viaduct, where they do it, one thing, one, and they don't just complain. There aren't any places in the country where you can have stars with vibrancy and people speaking soundly,
sure,
side by side.
Yep.
And all of the examples that people throw up have these issues. So the thing I was really keen to make sure, and what I hope I put on the table, is originally through the plan change, 40 or 42, where they were going to address the campus separately, and it got referred to this plan review. So that plan change, I put all the information on the table saying, these noise limits were labelled the bars for X, Y, Z, and a consequence of that is that the visitor accommodation is going to go A, B, C in terms of how they design the building or and then it's been up to others. So it's not an acoustic decision, it's a broader policy planning decision.
I understand that. But given your experience with acoustic related matters, given the more lenient approach to noise provided for by the PDC, do you have any feel for the likely consequence on visitor accommodation operators? Is there likely to be sort of is there a risk of an extreme response where they'll say, well, we can't operate anymore in this environment, we've got to sort of pack up and shift away, or the circumstance where it's a much lesser impact than that?
No, I mean, hopefully, so there's quite a difference between the existing district accommodation and the new district accommodation. So there's no bar on new district accommodation, but hopefully the plan will now encourage it to move towards the periphery of the town centre away from the bars and encourage the bars to move towards the centre. But hopefully that over time we get separation. In terms of the existing district accommodation, the more lenient noise limits are similar to the noise levels on the street at the moment. This has been one of the slightly dark things about the Oxford district plan noise limits is you've got people sitting in the courtyard of the bar checking and socialising, and then you've got people walking past on the streets. The opposite district plan is very tight on those people sitting in the courtyard, but it does nothing for the people walking on the street.
Right.
But the actual noise levels that the hotels are exposed to would probably in reality won't change. I mean, if you take the example of Icon, which is within the big bit, people walking up and down the wall are currently uncontrolled by the district plan, and the noise that's allowed from the farm of the proposed district plan will be a similar noise level to those people walking down the street we're already making. But I don't think that the impact is going to be a step change, so suddenly they're not viable in the town centre anymore.
All right, so it's not a significant change overall.
No, to some extent, it's legitimising a situation that already exists.
Yeah, and that dealt with through the resource and city type process anyway.
Yes.
To the level you've described.
The rules do allow for some more leniency, but to an extent.
And given your feel for it, if the new approach, as evidenced in the PDP, were adopted, is that going to remove the need for bar operators to seek resource consents?
In terms of the noise issues,
yeah.
Yes. I don't think there's the other planning issues that have come up.
Right.
In terms of the noise, it was nice to us to be able to operate.
Alrighty, thank you.
Just one more thing. Have any questions for Charles?
Right, thank you.
Just in your summary on paragraph 8, you make the point about the airport noise less than 57 decibels. Is that the actual or contour model noise you're referring to there?
It's the 2037 future model.
That's right, so that's the model.
Yep. So, right. So if you're building a new house, you've got to design for the future situation. So the point would hold true. If you build a house today, it would be protected from the action at that level. But
yes.
You have to design in the future.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fine. The other question that I have is more general, but I'd like your view as a noise expert. Reference to air noise boundary and out of control boundary. In your view, are they the same in conceptual and definition term, irrespective of the location of them, and if the location is related to the modelling? In other words, is an air noise boundary always an air noise boundary?
So the air noise boundary and the outer control boundary, you start off with your contours, and then sometimes they're adjusted. So you'll see them through frames, and they're adjusted to the cadastral boundaries through the residential zone, so you don't slice that residential section in half.
And to avoid the hospital.
And so sometimes they are adjusted. So technically, the sound level contour they're based on is British in the future. And so there are administrative.
So in reality, if you were looking at any airport in terms of the air noise boundary, you'd look at what had been mapped.
You'd look at the contour that had been modelled. Generally the sort of administrative adjustments are usually quite small.
Yes.
But I mean, you might compare the terms to, but by and large, they're pretty consistent. What is different is that different airports around the country apply different land use controls within the air control boundary and the air noise boundary.
Yes.
And quite markedly so. Wellington doesn't use the air control boundary, only uses the air noise boundary.
And Auckland uses different terms.
So the standard says, well, these are the land use controls we recommend within those two. And then the airport companies generally want to argue that there should be differences in just
Thank you. I have no other questions. Thank you. Dr. Charles.
Next witness for the council is Mr. Timothy Church. I think this is first appearance before the panel, but you may be aware of his qualifications and experience. Very experienced urban design expert, and he will read a summary. And I think point out a correction from the memorandum of corrections.
Yes, I'll take Mr. Church's expertise.
Thank you. Thank you.
We can move on to the summary.
Yes. Sir.
Good. I'll first address the Queenstown Council zone. Generally, I consider the notified permissive building height provisions in the proposed district plan maintain the character and sense of place. They strike an appropriate balance in heights and recession plan rules that maintain and encompasses a coherent collection of buildings across the Queenstown Town Centre. Nonetheless, I have recommended some changes for specific height precincts where I consider it appropriate from an urban design perspective. In most types of height precincts, heights can be further varied as a restricted discretionary activity. I support the matters of discretion with a suggested addition for landmark buildings. I support the non-notification of design matters. I do not support a statutory role for the urban design panel. In my view, an edited version of the special character area design guide should be provided for the balance of the zone. I consider on balance that a greater flexibility in the built form outcomes enabled through the removal of the ODP recession plan outweighs the potential adverse effects of additional height. However, in areas adjacent streets and public spaces are more sensitive, there are instances where I consider there is merit in retaining recession plan and lower street facade height rules. One particular area of focus is on the recently pedestrianised Beach Street to maintain public space amenity, where I support the removal of the setback on the northern side with associated amendments to facade heights and reverting back to the operative district plan ADP provisions on the southern frontage. I agree with Mr. Williams that design flexibility offered by restrictive discretionary provisions is effective, particularly in discrete locations. However, I do not agree with the suggested revision to precinct P5. I consider that the O'Connell Pavilion is not a discrete corner site. Carl Lane is not a genuine corner in the context of the Queenstown Street Grid for Stratton House. and there remains potential for greater visual dominance of the narrow beach street. Across the Mann Street block, I consider recommended provisions optimise the heights in precinct P7 and relate to the interpolated site levels and existing Mann Street car park building. I should also add the street levels as well. I also consider it appropriate to include view shaft through the block. I note a further review of modelling has occurred and has resulted in a memorandum recommending removal of the recession plane along the lowest shot over street. I have since identified a graphical error in the two location plans and have attached an updated version to Appendix A of the summary. I do not agree with suggestions to lower the language school height envelope. The height envelope drops steeply away from the boundary and it is an RD activity above 12 metres. There is a view shaft buffer between the development to the west of the site, and I consider the Sofitel Hotel to be relatively low rise at the Mann Street frontage in the context of potential PC50 outcomes opposite and the inner link routes adjacent. I do not agree with Mr. Williams that the lower height claim should apply to the western view shaft of that particular Mann Street block. It is level with the sloping Mann Street in this location and provides important layering opportunities for built forms. Blank walls can be architecturally treated to mitigate any interim adverse visual effects. I support the removal of the site coverage rule across the Queenstown Town Centre, except for sites requiring comprehensive development plans, where I suggest the site coverage should be 75%. If the comprehensive development plan's approach was included, which I support, the PDP threshold should be reduced to 1,400 square metres to trigger. I do not agree with Mr. Williams that the PDP threshold should be 1,800 square metres. I consider both the O'Connells and Stratton House sites already provide internal pedestrian links and an outdoor zoning terrace. I support maintaining and enhancing the existing network of pedestrian links through targeted rule 12.5.8.1. I support a further distinction in the type of pedestrian links being formed between arcades and lanes. I consider the alignment of new pedestrian links should not be mandatory at this stage and instead secured through other planning mechanisms with guidance through non-statutory documents. I do not agree with Mr. Williams regarding the removal of the internal Sky City Arcade from the planning map. I acknowledge that Cowell Lane and Sky City Arcade are in close proximity, but Cowell Lane is a more service-orientated laneway, while the arcade is an enclosed pedestrian-based retail environment. Stratton House has a dual retail frontage within the site and places back of house to the public lane. The arcade is more direct than the other through block link in the vicinity. Under the CDP mechanism, this could be located anywhere on site and it would still be effective in my view. However, I anticipate the likelihood of the site being redeveloped is low, while the likelihood of the access way being cut off for public use is high. If the latter occurs, then the quality and safety of the pedestrian network could be compromised by using the service lane as an alternative. I turn now to the Wanaka Town Centre zone. I consider the notified 12-metre E 14-metre ridge line for the Wanaka Height Precinct overlay to be appropriate, and I support its extension along Dungarvan Street. Regarding the Wanaka Height Precinct overlay along Colwick Street, I agree in part with the suggestion to increase the permitted building heights for the urban design-related reasons outlaid by the submitters. I consider that a 10-metre eave and a 12-metre ridge line with a three-storey cap would be appropriate minimum height control for Upper Colwick Street. However, I do not agree that this should be to the full height of the height precinct, given the outcomes of the shading modelling in relation to how work in Dunmore Street amenity and the potential shading effects on the transitional town centre zone south of Branston Street. I've been involved in the correspondence with Mr. James and I've been involved with the correspondence Ms. Jones has been having with Mr. Greaves and Ms. Wright regarding the updated modelling for the one of the Crown Centre. I agree with Ms. Jones' recommendation for the second height precinct. My views on the site coverage maximum, the CDPs and the pedestrian links were the same as in the Queenstown Town Centre zone. I find in terms of the business mixed use zone, I consider both the residential and non-residential uses should be subject to the same activity status and level of design review. I support the PDD approach, introducing the restricted discretionary activity status for buildings and non-notification of design matters. I support the intention of the matters of discretion and in notified rule 16.4.2. However, I suggest they better capture the key urban design qualities that are described in notified objective 6.2.1 and 6.2.2 and be robust enough to manage the effects of high density mixed-use development. I support PDP permitted building heights up to 12 metres for the zone and RD heights to 20 metres east of Gorge Road, with the exception of the Caltex service station and Gorge Centre sites. In my view, those two sites and all those areas to the west of Gorge Road should have a lower maximum restricted discretionary height of up to 15 metres. In my view, the notified PDC 35 degree decision plane should be retained on boundaries with residential zones, except for allowing an increase of 45 degrees on the northern boundary. I consider there should be provision for minimum usable outdoor living space for residential activities, appropriate to the size of the unit, with flexibility for it to be used as communal space. I also consider a rule requiring a minimum 10% landscape coverage should be added. I agree with Mr. Freeman that the specific setback distances for Gorge Road would provide further clarity in interpreting the rule. I also consider it appropriate that public access, daylighting and remediation would form creek be incentivised through the consenting process. I do not agree with Mr. Freeman's suggestion to remove the Horn Creek provisions. I consider there a significant opportunity to implement the creek's enhancement during its transition phase. I anticipate an upzoning benefit may bring more rapid change to the area, allowing greater coordination opportunities between the site owners. The creek can be effectively incorporated on site, has been successfully demonstrated in more constrained Queenstown Town Centre zone developments such as the Naitahu Courthouse development. I agree with Mr. Freeman's suggestion of a parallel council-led initiative for the holistic approach to daylighting of Horn Creek, including advanced realignment and incorporation within the wider business mixed use zone design guidance for consistency of outcome. However, I consider that the district plan remains an important policy support and that the provisions for rehabilitation should be included. Given the business mixed use zone is new in the PDP, I recommend the council prepare a non-statutory zone guidance.
Good, thank you very much. Can I just start, please, with the various models, the shading and light diagrams that you've included in your principal evidence. Without getting into the detail of them, I want to understand from you the sort of, if you like, the degree of accuracy, the degree of reliability we should attach to those representations. You know, like others, with some data about kind of an assessment of margins of error and the like. I really want to understand from you how realistic you think these representations actually are of the real world.
Well, bearing in mind a lot of these are based on the height envelope, and so in reality that envelope, you know, the actual built forms that were designed within that envelope could change. So we must have at a high level in respect to the envelopes. In terms of the actual, we have, in terms of the shadow modelling itself, we have provided a methodology in the report which I think accurately portrays the sensitivities around the model. But probably the key thing I should point out is each site is averaged. So the model is not rolling necessarily with the topography underneath. It's been assumed that the building will take an average height across each site, and that was something that the council, an assumption that the council used when they did the modelling of the site originally. In terms of the actual shadows cast, we've used a pretty reliable source in terms of the my use of the term, I think. I've been relying on sort of quite accurate city engine modelling to achieve that, but I think the shadows that are cast are highly accurate in that regard. And we have used LiDAR, which is to a fairly, a fairly high accuracy for casting those shadows over a terrain.
All right, so just touching on the methodology and the models used, would I be correct in thinking that these are standard for this type of assessment, but commonly utilised up and down the country?
Yes, I mean, from my experience, I use these regularly, the City Engine is a geographically information-based service, so the software that is exceptionally accurate.
And in terms of, you've touched on some assumptions that have been made in relation to running the model or models. Any of those assumptions, do they strike you as being different, unusual, somehow unique, not assumptions that you've not commonly made?
Well, I think for the time that we had, the budget that we had, the amount of information we had, given this was at a high level just a plan review process, I think it is the best we could have achieved in the time, given the circumstances of this. So they are reliable, but I think if you were to interrogate site by site approach, you might take a more accurate, you would be modelling the actual built forms and you would be using more site contour data to give you a less average building footprint across that site. If that makes sense.
It does make sense, but say if we were inclined to do that and we went out and sought data on specific sites, I guess what I'm wanting to understand from you, that if we compared the individual site assessments against what you've done here, we wouldn't sort of go, wow, that's completely different.
It shouldn't be radically different. If you're referring to the Mann Street site, we have actually modelled that a bit more accurately using the information provided by the submitter. So we've interpolated, we've taken an approach which would typically be taken by an applicant submitted to a council on a typical resource consent, using the data available. So on the Mann Street sites, we've gone to another level of detail. On some of the other sites, we've taken more of an average-based approach on the sites.
Okay, thank you. Just looking specifically at figure 24, this is the Brisbane Street shading. And I just couldn't quite follow that. There was a legend where blue should be PDP and red should be proposed.
No, sorry,
Yeah, figure 24, and it's for T1. And it's the showing the shading. And on the other diagrams, I read the blue line for PDP and the red for proposed, but I was looking for my red and blue line.
Sorry, that is a mistake.
Right.
So essentially, if you just refer to the with all the other shadow modelling, we've been providing red and blue lines which relate to the two different versions. In this case, we've provided the versions. We haven't actually overlaid the PDP 12 metre line over the pink model, if you like. So we haven't provided a...
So there's not a comparison.
We haven't provided a comparison. That's right.
It's just that you've modelled 12 metres against 15.5 metres.
That's right.
Right. Okay.
It's probably worth noting, in terms of interpreting the other models, is that the lines really show an extreme example, the extremity of that shading.
Well, if we can take, say, an example of the green space area, perhaps, a bit of green shading on figure 12, and you can talk us through that one if you may.
Sure. So really there's a couple of key things that we should be looking at. So what we've done is we've tracked the shadows around as an hourly increment. The ODP shadow modelling is not provided in this figure, but what we've done is we've provided the blue line is existing, and so the shadow differences at the most extreme event, i.e. probably at I think either 11 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I think it's in the morning in this case, is provided in as outlines around the outside of the shadow. So the equivalent of that extreme example is outlined in the blue, which is what would be existing. But really what we need to review is the intensity differences between those two models. We haven't provided the two versions, if you like, because we felt that the difference between the two were pretty minimal, because in this particular instance we were only looking at one section of the building, which was the KFC building, and so all other buildings would be relative, essentially the same.
Right. So when I'm looking at that shading diagram, what just remind me, what do I take the blue line to represent?
The existing
environment.
The existing height envelope for the operative district thing.
Right. And red?
And the red is the proposed. The red is the proposed district plan. Well, the red is the proposed district plan should the KFC building be
somehow changed.
That's a complicated one because the PDP was essentially retained as shown.
Okay. Alright. Now, your principal evidence, you review submissions and things of that sort, but you also make some suggestions based on your experience and expertise. And it just raised the issue in my mind of scope.
Mm-hmm.
And can I take it that the recommendations you have made, are they within scope or beyond scope?
Yes, I believe they are.
They are within scope. So I should read the evidence that the suggestions made for change are within scope of submissions. Is that right, Mr. Winches?
My understanding, sir. As far as this evidence is concerned, yes.
Alright. And
I just want to pop through, and I've got a top story of questions, sorry, so you can just have to bear with me as I go through. You're talking about some documents being incorporated, and when you're discussing the Wanaka Town Centre, you refer to the veranda guidelines. Are they an incorporated document, are they, in the plan?
There are some guidelines in the character, in the Wanaka Town Centre character guidelines. I'll probably draw, we originally in my evidence that there's some evidence on verandas, and we had since omitted that evidence, and so that there was a reference to verandas in there that might have been a hangover from that clause.
So Mr. Winchester, the veranda guidelines, are they going to appear in that list of incorporated documents that we're going to check?
Yes, in the first instance.
Yes. Okay. I just want to take you to your paragraph 518 and 519. Now, I've read them through a few times, but could you just sort of help me and explain the contents of those? I know the summation paragraphs, but just in your own words.
So when you look at the height limits within the 12 metre height limits within the strip, the proposed district plan. There is an allowance for up to four stories as a cap for that. So you can develop up to 12 metres and incorporate up to four stories in that. So it's sort of a catch, a both ends. It's my view that buildings up to four stories and that under that 12 metre height limit is really constraining the interfloor heights of that building, and so what you end up with is either a compromise somewhere along that elevation. So you get either a low floor height, or a low ground level floor height, which is less adaptable from a range of different activities, or what seems to happen is you have constrained interfloor heights as you go up, which potentially squeezes things like a barrier reform or having to really constrain that upper level, often meaning habitable spaces go up into the roof space itself. So I think when we looked at a number of examples around the town centre, and I've provided a few in my evidence, I felt that it was that additional floor was too constrained and wasn't really providing the diversity of roof form and the diversity of the good quality facade heights that that really provides for a high quality urban environment in that respect. Does that answer your question? The removal of the
it was really the final sentence in paragraph 519. Therefore, in my view, deadly urban design outcomes could be achieved by removing the reference or amending the cap to three stories.
So I think you either remove the, I think by indicating a four-storey height cap is really trying to say that four stories is an acceptable solution, urban design solution in that accounting. So, environment, and in my view that is not an acceptable solution, so that shouldn't really be anticipated within the plan and should not really give the signal to developers that that's an acceptable outcome.
Okay.
Now, in terms of, again, of a bit of an overview of reading of evidence, I took it because of the existing environment, particularly in the town centre, that the urban design panel is a reasonably pretty important element. And yet, the conversation pans out that the urban design panel, you don't favour it being sort of part of the statutory regime. And you say the main reason for that is, as I took it from your evidence, the main reason you put forward was that you were concerned it would compromise its independence. Are you able to expand on that for us, please? What do you mean by it's going to, if you've made it part of the statutory process, how's it going to compromise its independence?
Well, there's a couple of points to probably take into account. I mean, I have the experience of being on the panel, on the urban design panel in Christchurch, not the one in Queenstown. But the panel, I guess, has taken a broader view than just what the constraints are within the district plan. It tends to look at design outcomes across the board, about the bridges of looking at the plan rules itself. I think the flexibility of the panel would be constrained in my view if it was just relating to the district plan and feeling constrained by that. The other thing that I consider is that the panelists come from a diverse range of backgrounds, and so I think and I understand the Queenstown panel has a lay person on the panel as well, and so I think not all the panelists are just in favour of the district plan process, and therefore I think to tie that up with a decision making body or with someone who can make a recommendation on a district plan outcome, I think that both limits the panel and provides and not necessarily provides the advice that is target enough for that plan.
Okay. And do you have experience of the urban design panel working here in Queenstown?
No, I've been in front of the panel twice myself, but only for applicants, but as an applicant.
And currently it's not part of the statutory process, is that true? It's recommendatory?
Yes, that's my understanding. And it's a voluntary service, is my understanding.
Right. Just picking up another topic about the laneways and the walkways, they seem to be a key feature of the town centre again. And you, in your principal evidence, talk about kind of varying sort of non-statutory means or ways in which additional laneways may be provided. How do you actually see that happening in terms of a planning process? What sort of thoughts did you have in mind about it?
So I think the way that I've suggested or recommended in my evidence is that for those outside the character guideline area would be part of a non-statutory guidance approach, and so the council would prepare or would continue to evolve its urban design character guidelines and the urban design strategy, which would provide a non-statutory, I guess, alignment or suggested alignment of potential positive pedestrian connections that could happen outside that zone. That would then inform the way that the the comprehensive development plans could be interpreted under the statutory provisions, and that could be then negotiated through the application process.
So it kind of takes place for sort of pre-application type meetings, being the forum and structure. And
I think by fixing an alignment, an alignment that doesn't exist in the plan, without the input of a developer or an applicant, I think my preference is for the flexibility to remain with the applicant as to the exact alignment where those lanes might be. I give you an example, I think, in my evidence around the Christchurch City plan with the retail precinct, and the fact that there was an allowance for two laneways within a comprehensive block, and that block and the developer had the flexibility as to where that laneway would align, and all the other associated benefits with that.
Business zones such as Queenstown Town Centre Zone, where councils want laneways or open space or those sorts of things, do they normally provide some sort of bonus provision so that there's a quid pro quo, if you like? But is that your experience elsewhere in the country?
I think there has been, from what I understand, there have been bonuses provided in some instances. I don't know a lot of instances of those personally, from my personal experience.
Just in your summary, paragraph 13. I just want to clarify, first of all, in the second sentence you talk about an appropriate minimum height control. Is that what you mean?
Can you just refer to the
paragraph 13? Yes. In your summary.
Oh, my summary.
Yes.
So what were your relations?
And in the second sentence, you say, consider a 10 metre E 12 metre ridgeline would be an appropriate minimum height control. Is that what you mean?
No, it's a maximum
additional length. Now then you go on and say you agree with Ms. Jones's recommendations for a second height precinct. We haven't heard Ms. Jones yet. Could you just explain what you agree with, please?
Sure. It's my understanding that Ms. Jones will be bringing an additional height precinct into the Helwick Street area in particular. Which relates to a slightly lower height than what's been provided for on the Wanaka height precinct, the Wanaka height precinct for height overlay. We have had sort of evidence from Mr. Wright and Mr. Greave relating to to increasing that height from a built form argument. I think they raise relevance points which relate to currently the Wanaka Height precinct is really about hospitality, sort of giving the urban forms of the hospitality and entertainment part of Ardmore Street. They rightly say in my mind that there should be a good urban form related to the retail precinct of Helwick Street, which is the primary retail strip leading to the lake. But we then further questioned the shading analysis of that, and I think they provided three options. One was to go to the same height as the Wanaka Height precinct. Another is to drop that down to the 10 metres with the 12 metre ridgeline option, which I think in terms of the evidence provided, the interfloor heights and the relationship between those heights, I think we're comfortable with in that. And the overshadowing onto Helwick Street, which is one of the concerns that I had with increasing the height along that street at lunchtime, is relieved by those heights. So basically that's 12.
And the shadowing, the shading across Brownston into the transition zones.
So that was the one concern I had, was that there would be some potential shading of that transitional zone, but not as much as the one that the Park would provide for. But I think on balance, given there are only two buildings at that gateway to Helwick Street off the Brownston corner, and that tracking would be largely in that winter period over a short period of time, and given the transitory nature of that zone, I'm in support of that approach.
Services that are accessible to residential areas and people in transit. The zone policies do not provide for the centre to be developed in a manner that is inconsistent with what they currently represent, nor does the zone purpose encourage or enable larger commercial activities. I understand the zone seeks to enable people to purchase convenience goods and services without the requirement to travel greater distances to larger town centres. Convenience goods and services are typically those goods and services that are frequently required to purchase by the market. They typically involve quick stop or short stay visits and generally involve top-up purchases or purchases on the run when tapping into the drive-by market. In that regard, they are often intended opportunistic purchases. In my view, the purpose, objectives and policies of the zone are appropriately pitched to facilitate the development of appropriate activity and tenancy types. However, to ensure the development meets the zone's envisaged outcomes, I recommended the following amendment. A. A maximum individual tenancy size of 300 square metres for a store area. Restrict retail to the store types that can establish in the zone through the exclusion of some non-convenient store types due to their reliance on drawing custom from beyond the local area of any LSDS. In regard to the zone at 1 Hanson Road, the extent of the zone is reduced to and the maximum size of individual opportunities is implemented at 200 square metres per day. In relation to the submission to provide from Willowridge Development, I agree with setting the maximum tenancy GFA. However, I would support a slightly lower maximum cap of 300 square metres versus the 400 they promoted. In my experience, convenience store types in small centres are around 170 square metres GFA on average, and higher order centres have an average store size of between 275 and 300 square metres GFA. This includes department stores and supermarkets, which because of their scale obviously attract the average up. Stores larger than 400 square metres will attract shoppers from well beyond their local residential areas. As such, I consider 300 square metres a more appropriate cap for meeting the small scale purpose of the zone, whilst at the same time providing an appropriate level of flexibility for the market. In my view, restricting certain store types which are more suitable and aligned to larger town centres is also warranted. The majority of retail stores nominally in a market are below 300 square metres GFA. This includes higher order non-convenience stores. As such, I support the exclusion of some non-convenience store types from the zone, as they will rely on attracting customers from well beyond any local market to generate sales. This will also conflict with the zone purpose, objectives and pricing.
Could we stop you there for lunch? Because you're going on to the one piece of road, which is quite a lot of discussion. I think it's probably better to stop there and go on for another few pages. And we'll adjourn to a shop. Thank you.